Okay, we heard that we now have the outline, actually, believe it or not, the guts of the outline upon which the next set of genes work on. So this is the structural backbone of the cell cycle, if you will, with cyclin D, CDK4, a protein kinase that phosphorylates RB that releases E2F. Cyclin E, CDK2, the second step, where releases more E2F. The entry into S phase with cyclin A, CDK2, the entry into G2, B, CDK2, and M, CDK1B. Right? Okay, so there are cyclins watching over structurally progression through the cell cycle. And these cyclins are quite interesting because they're in some sense the end product of signal transduction pathways, which we'll introduce tomorrow. Right? These are the pathways that come from the growth factors. Right? So the growth factors are external to the cell. They sit like if you have a wound. That's a very good example because a wound is like cancer. So if you get a wound, the platelets come to the wound. They start filling in the wound, and then that starts a fibrotic process that prevents the blood from escaping. But the platelets liberate platelet-derived growth factor. That growth factor stimulates fibroblasts to divide, so there's enough nutrients, there's now a platelet-derived growth factor. It runs the cells through cell cycle, and you get a terrific proliferation to fill in the wound. Right? And the product of platelet-derived growth factor engaging its receptor is a series of activities which result in cyclin D CDK4 being synthesized. Okay? So in other words, throwing the cell into cycle. So if it was in G0, which we know very little about, by a resting cell sitting there, right, it would throw the cell into cycle by the synthesis of D, right? So that's what's happening. Now, it turns out that there are a series of checks and balances on this progression through cell cycle. And the reason is really all about fidelity, right? As you might guess, if you want to duplicate 3 billion bits of information during the cell cycle, that's just the S phase. There are 3 billion A's, T's, G's, and C's in the DNA, and you want to do it faithfully. That's just the first part of it. Because what else you have to do is divide those 3 billion bits of information into two cells equally, and you have to, at some point, reproduce all of the components of the cell. And so when you're finished, it is a big process of faithfully transmitting enough information to actually divide the cell. Now, there's inherent limits on that fidelity. So let's just talk a little bit about DNA fidelity, because this is going to be the topic. Fidelity is everything in cancer. I mean, if you're faithful, you won't get cancer, right? So because it's mutations or mistakes that give rise to these cancers. So the ability to copy DNA, if you just wanted to copy DNA with DNA polymerase, right, fidelity comes from, first of all, the base pair, the chemical aspects of the base pair. A's pair with T's, they do so by two hydrogen bonds. G's pairs with C's by three hydrogen bonds. And the formation of those hydrogen bonds gives you some amount of kilocalories that ensure fidelity. T does not pair with G. Right? And it doesn't pair with G because you don't get the energy from the hydrogen bonds properly. Right? So you have a certain fidelity in the chemistry itself. Right? The enzyme supplies yet more fidelity. The enzyme checks the A's and makes sure that you pair with T. It checks the G and makes sure you pair with C. So the enzyme gives you a certain amount of fidelity. And if you just use an enzyme, right, plus the base pairs that you have, right, you get about an error rate of about 10 to the minus 4th to 10 to the minus 5th. That means 1 in 10,000, 1 in 100,000 times you make a mistake, right? Now that's too high an error rate to tolerate, because you have 3 times 10 to the 9th base pairs to, you could just, now, where's our friend? Yeah, you could just calculate that very quickly, and you'll see that you make 10 to 6 mistakes, right? Or 10 to 5th mistakes. You change seats. I noticed you move farther. wants to move farther away from me. That's I'm not that threatening, I don't think. So the enzyme has started to evolve processes to lower the mistake rate or increase the fidelity. It has certain repair processes. So, for example, the enzymes themselves, DNA polymerases, often have what are called exonucleases associated with them. So if it sees a mistake, let's say you've now paired a G with a T, right? It doesn't make a proper bond. It notices that, and it removes by nuclease treatment the T, and then tries a C, and then it gets it right, right? These are called editing functions, right? Editing functions get the fidelity rate up from about 10 to the minus 4th, 10 to the minus 5th, up to about 10 to the minus 8th. And the fidelity rate is about 10 to the minus 8th, right? In most good polymerizing systems. From E. coli through humans, if you could calculate a rate, it's very hard to calculate a rate because you never really know how many divisions you go through, but if you can calculate a rate, it's about 10 to the minus 8th. And that means for humans, you make about 10 or 30 mistakes every time you replicate, right? And you do that. You make about 10 to 30 mistakes every time you replicate cells. Since 97% of your DNA is not encoding informational parts of the DNA, but in other kinds of parts of the DNA, you could tolerate that. And it isn't really usually a problem for you, right? It becomes a problem if it's inherited and it's in an important gene. And there's a spontaneous rate of hemophilia, there's a spontaneous rate of retinoblastoma you saw. These are spontaneous errors that have occur at certain frequencies in different genes. And across the size of the gene, the cross-section of the gene, how much of the genome it takes, all these things are important variables in fidelity, in the fidelity rates, okay? So that's roughly the rate. Now, let me say there's some interesting things about fidelity. Like, evolution can, in fact, let me get rid of this. Evolution can, in fact, set the fidelity rate. That's a kind of interesting concept. You can set your own fidelity rate, right? So a classic experiment that showed this was to grow bacterium chemostats, right? So chemostats are steady state machines where you put the bacteria in, you drip in glucose and other kinds of good things, oxygen, everything else, at the same rate all the time, and you drain out wastes at the same rate all the time, and you keep the population steady by draining out the increasing number of cells so the population stays steady. And these chemostats are as good as we can get, they vary a bit, in getting the conditions exactly the same, right? All right, so you have one chemostat in which nothing changes over the whole experiment. And the experiment could be, let's say, 100 or 200 generations. And then you have another chemostat where you wildly start to change the conditions. I'm changing the glucose, I'm changing the oxygen. I'm not stirring at the same rate. I stop stirring and then I start stirring. So what I'm doing here is I'm keeping the environment either constant or I'm constantly changing the environment, right? And then at the end of 100 generations, I sample the bacteria that are left and I determine the mutation rate. Right? I look at the rate at which these bacteria are now making mutations. And if you live in a wildly changing environment, your mutation rate goes up. Right? Now that's a nice genetic adaptation, if you think about it, to living in wildly varying environments. What you're doing is you're changing in response to these environments at faster rates. You're evolving at a faster rate by at least giving the distribution of possible bacteria that you can have, the sequences in the genome, much broader width.
Can you separate it from selection, which might occur there as well?
No, selection occurs and it's not clearly separated from it. But you're constantly changing the environment, so you're not quite selecting for the same thing all the time. And that's the one thing. It doesn't mean that there isn't something you're selecting for, like growing on walls. The bacteria often love to grow on walls rather than in the suspension. But you can avoid that by taking only the bacteria out from suspension, things like that. So you're not clearly eliminating selection, but what you're getting by varying the environment through selection plus that kind of variation is a higher mutation rate. Right? Now, that's not surprising. Mutation rate is set, I just told you, by the polymerase and all the associated proteins. So mutations in the polymerase have a higher error rate, right? And we see that all the time. Right? So we can set our own mutation rate up to a limit. Right?
How much larger is it?
What happens, you see, is different classes of mutations. So it's not, but if I take all mutations and lump them together, it could be a 30% increase. It's a pretty significant increase, but it's not double, right? All right. So there's some, let me just finish. Some organisms that actually have higher mutation rates because fidelity is not as good, right? I'm going to talk about viruses. RNA viruses, like influenza is a very good example. Then the mutation rate is 10 to minus 4th or 10 to minus 5th, right? And it is right at what we call the error catastrophe threshold, right? In other words, they have to have some fidelity of information, otherwise your virus wouldn't make a virus, right? So it is right at this error catastrophe threshold. And if you throw it at a higher mutation rate, it will kill itself. Right? And in fact, many of these viruses are dead when they're made. Why? Because the mutation rate's so high. But of course, they live in this world of escaping your immune system. And that's the strategy they use. Right? So influenza can come back every year because it has such a high mutation rate, it actually has escaped the immune system that you used last year to keep you away the influenza. Right? And it lives on this error catastrophe threshold where it produces as many dead viruses as live viruses. Right? And at that point, we call those viruses quasi-species because they're not one sequence. They are a distribution of sequences. And the winner is determined by you, the host, and the immune system. Right? Sorry, there was a question.
So the mutations were they identified for specific parts that were changing, or was it completely random?
No, the mutation is random, but then the selection comes in, and so the mutation rate is set by all those genes that make proteins that replicate the DNA, right? In that experiment with bacteria, right? In other words, there are 100 genes that make proteins that are important in DNA replication, and those are the targets for setting a higher mutation rate or a lower mutation rate by fidelity of DNA replication, right? There's also fidelity of repair and fidelity of other things, but yeah.
But for each generation, you said it was for humans it's about 10 to 30. For bacteria, is a similar number because you.
Oh no, bacteria have very small, much smaller genomes. So bacteria could faithfully replicate themselves because their genome is 1,000 times smaller than our genome.
So how many? Replication, how many generations does it take to get one mutation on average for each trajectory?
How many generations for a bacteria? Or for a human or what?
About 100 generations for one mutation?
No, not in bacteria. Bacteria, you'll get. So bacteria set their mutation rates depending on their environments. So it isn't so simple to say that there's some bacteria that every generation you'll generate a few mutations. But you won't see them, and you only see them by selection.
The example you gave, what was the rate roughly?
The bacteria have a fidelity of about 10 to minus 8, right? They have a genome of about, 10 to minus 10 to the 6 nucleotides.
So the 100 generations per mutation. So, and you said the experiment was 100 generations.
Under some conditions, it could be as many as 100 generations, yes. But it's never that, really, because they're setting their mutation rate, right?
Now, as a rule of thumb, so for physicists, just remember, one mutation per genome generation, right? It's not one, it's a tenth, right? And bacteria can be 100.
Yeah. Well, but we grow them up to 10 to the minus 10 to the ninth, right? So multiply your number by 10 to the ninth, and you'll see how many mutations occur in the population, right? So 100, right, into 10 to the ninth is 10 to the seventh. So you'll have 10 to the seventh mutations in that population of bacteria.
Right, but you're talking about population. I'm talking about individual.
Yes, lines. You're talking about one bacteria, yes, which we never work with, but yes.
Because then you're throwing away most of them. people. And most of them die of something.
So we're selecting. We never see these mutations. We're selecting from the 10th to the 7th the mutation we want to see and measure, right? Yeah. But you're right. For one bacteria, it could go through 100 generations without mutating. That's true. From a single bacteria. But people don't usually like to work with a single bacteria because it's really hard to keep separating the two after they divide and looking in the microscope. And right? So we don't. That experiment, I don't think, has ever been done by...
With microfluidics, you can do that.
You could do it with microfluidics, that's right. Yes, modern microscopes, yes. Okay. Right. But that's an irrelevancy to what I want to talk about. Okay. So now we what we found is, and I didn't make it so clear, so let me make it clear. While retinoblastoma protein was found as part of a cancer, the retinoblasts in cancer, this is a protein that's present in every cell of your body, and it functions the same way in every cell of your body, and it functions at this point at the G1S phase transition, and it functions by binding E2F and stopping it from turning on S phase. It's the transcription factor that turns on S phase, right? And it's relieved from doing that by phosphorylations of CDK4 and CDK2DE, right? That's its mechanism. And remember, this is at the end of a large path of signaling the cell to divide, right? That's the concept behind this. Now, it has been asked many times, why is it, if it's in every cell, that you get retinoblastoma rather than you get lung cancer? Well, the truth is, we don't understand the inherited basis of this. There's a distinction between inheriting the retinoblastoma mutation and spontaneous mutations that cause cancer, because all lung cancers have retinoblastoma mutations. Right? But you never get them if you inherit it. Now, it's possible that it take a long time to get lung cancer and you die of retinoblastoma or of bone cancer before you ever get there. That's possible. But having said that, we don't understand why it is that inheriting this mutation, it's behaving in a tissue-specific way differently than it's behaving if it's a spontaneous mutation that has occurred sometime during your lifetime in a cell, right? So let's just leave it as something that's a good question that we don't understand. Right. Now,
is the location on where the mutation occurs irrelevant also on these smaller molecules?
So the mutation you get, it's not irrelevant at all. If the mutation, the protein itself has 30 phosphorylation sites, mm-hmm. right? If the mutation occurred not in one of those sites, it wouldn't affect phosphorylation, and therefore it wouldn't be, right? So what the most common mutation you see is a chain termination mutation that actually doesn't make the protein at all. That's the single most common mutation. So it's a type of mutation, the chain termination type that doesn't even make the protein. A deletion would be the same kind of thing. These are the most common, right? And that tells you that it's the phosphorylation that's important as an issue for E2F. Yeah. So it is only a subset of mutations that are really important, right? Okay, so now let me introduce you to the second player. And that player here, so RB is the first player. There's a second player called P53. Which actually acts at both sides of this M1, right? So as the telomere shortens, as you go through divisions and the telomere shortens, it gets to a point where there's an alarm sounding, right? So there, if you have a break in the DNA, double-stranded break in the DNA, this is a disaster. Why is it a disaster? Because it raises the error rate about a thousandfold. So if you try to replicate anything, this is like recording. If you try to record over something that has a scratch in it, you get worse and worse and worse across the scratch. And this is exactly the same problem here. It is impossible to be replicating with these. Now there are repair systems, right? But they don't work so well, right? And the first thing that has to happen for a repair system to actually get started, right? The very first thing that has to happen is you have to recognize that you've had a problem, right? And here, in the telomere problem is an end problem, right? But it is formally similar to these kinds of breaks, right? Your end is now eroding. And there is a sensor that you have a problem. And the sensor is called an ATM, and it's a protein kinase. Okay. Now, ATM, forget about where the name comes from. It comes from ataxia telangiectasia mutant, right? People who have inherited this mutation have a terrible developmental disease called ataxia, and they have birth defects, and they have a large number of problems. Why? Because there are mutations all over the place, right? And these large number of developmental problems are caused by a failure, and this protein kinase was originally isolated as part of that failure, to understand it. And that's why it was called ataxia telangiectasia. But it is the protein kinase that recognizes these breaks, right? And sits on these breaks, right? And what does it phosphorylate? Like all protein kinases, what its target is pretty interesting. It actually phosphorylates a protein called P53. Now, P53, like E2F, is a transcription factor. And P53, right, will make a series of proteins that are regulated by this transcription factor. Now, the very phosphorylation of P53 by ATM is one of the triggers to activate this protein. P53 is usually pretty quiescent, right? But it's activated by DNA damage of all kinds. So you go outside, you have ultraviolet radiation. Ultraviolet radiation causes thymine dimers. So where thymine occurs twice, you make a dimer. The dimer, if you make it across the strand, you can't separate strands. Even when it's adjacent to the strand, you'll make errors, right? So you have to, what you do is you excise the thymine dimer, you extend the excision, and then you repair it, right? That's a different process than single-stranded breaks. It's from sunlight rather than from gamma radiation, for example, or X-ray radiation, which makes these breaks. It doesn't use ATM. It uses a different guide called ATR. It's related to this kinase, right? So there are sensors that are sensing damaged DNA. Damaged DNA is really bad because the mutation rate goes up 1,000-fold. Okay? All of these sensors end up coming through. Every one of these sensors for stress ends up coming through and alarming this protein, P53. Now, if I start to list the stresses, right, that alarm P53, you're going to see all the things that can go wrong. Hypoxia. The lack of oxygen is a stress, and it alarms P53. Heat shock. Temperature rises, 108 degrees, right? Fahrenheit, right? That's a bad situation. It alarms P53. Cold shock, right? Lower the temperature too much. It alarms P53. Nutrient deprivation. If an anorexic woman, right, alarms P53. She isn't taking in any glucose, and she's now deprived of nutrients. Right? And that put it in human context, but cells can be deprived of nutrients, and it'll alarm P53. Right? So P53 responds to all of these. Actually, even oncogene activation alarms P53. We'll talk about that. That means an abnormal signal for growth will alarm P53. Almost every kind of stress, actually even psychological stress. Right? So people who are depressed, right? This is actually quite a job. People are sleep deprived. Sleep deprivation turns out to be a stress. So if you're sleep deprived because you have a mutation in the clock, that's your biological clock, if you're sleep deprived, your cortisol levels go up. If your cortisol levels go up, it actually activates a protein kinase that activates P53. So psychological stress actually activates this protein. So it is sitting at a node, a central node of all the stresses that you might imagine are really important. And sitting at that central node, what does it do? Right? Okay, so one of the proteins it makes is called P21, right? And P21 is an inhibitor of cyclin E CDK2. Okay, so, I could stop the cell cycle from progressing if there's a stress, right? Now there's a second inhibitor, it's a very interesting locus. Remember, I don't want you to get intimidated by names, but I'm giving you the names. You want to forget them as fast as you hear them so that they don't start to pile up, right? There's a locus called INC4A, which has two genes in it. One makes a protein P16. What does P16 do? Inhibits cyclin D CDK4, right? But it has a second gene, which is a little bit, for those real connoisseurs, it's not important. It's, you read this, this is the exon. P16 has three exons. You read this exon, and then you come into this exon at a reading frame. So you're actually reading in two different reading frames across these exons, right? That's very unusual in the human genome. If you have, I don't know if anybody, does everybody know what reading frames are? Reading frames, so I don't, it's not really worth explaining it, but so if I, but I have to almost, because I now I mentioned it, so all genes start with the letters ATG, right? All genes, that's quite a, it's like a capital at the beginning of the sentence, ATG, right? But that puts in register everything downstream, right? If you always start at the same place, then the next three are read for these amino acids that they're read for, right? ATG is methionine, the next guy, the next guy, the next guy. So suppose I didn't start at ATG, but I started at G, A, something else. Now I've just shifted the frame one, right? So that's called the reading frame, right? So this P16 makes a particular protein of particular amino acids. This guy comes along and is read in a different reading frame here, starts off one over, right, and makes a completely different amino acid. And because of that, it's called R, alternate reading frame, right? Okay, so why are those important, right? Because in the Hayflick experiment, I now know what to look for. The first thing I see here is P53 goes through the roof here, right? Its activity goes way up. It gets phosphorylated. Why? Because the telomeres are eroding. It's sensing the telomere erosion with ATM. ATM phosphorylates P53. P53 makes P21. P21 stops the cell cycle, and that's mortality one, right? But there's a second check. If I watch what's happening, P16 levels go up, and ARF levels go up, right? So throughout, so P53 is discreetly turned on at late times by the eroding telomeres, but at throughout every division, right, the levels are creeping up in cells of these two guys, P16, which now stops this, right, and P21, which now stops this, right, is great, and ARF, which is really sort of interesting, because P53, let me point out something. P53 is a strange beast. And the reason is that I told you that all these stresses go through a single node. That's a very vulnerable design. Why? Because if you lose that, you lose all the stress responses. Yeah?
Does that mean in a P53 knockout, you go straight to M2?
Yes. Exactly. Exactly. So if you, and that's exactly what happens with SP40. It knocks out P53. SP40, you'll see it knocks out P53 and RP, and you go right into M2. At that point, telomere erosion is not checked, right?
But it knocks it out at the at what level?
Oh, it knocks out at the protein level. It binds the protein, actually. So it's a protein-protein interaction. While you knock out for cancer P53 and RB by mutation, the viruses knock it out by making a protein that knocks it out, right? The viruses are more efficient than the mutation rates. Yeah. Yes.
How does the ATM sense the lengths of the telomeres, and at what is there like known how concentration changes with number of repeats?
We don't know.
What do we know?
What we know is if you knock out ATM, you don't sense it. So we know that it does sense it, but we don't know how it senses. You asked how does it sense it.
How, and also do we know quantitatively like how the lengths of telomeres depend?
No, because as I mentioned before, in some situations longer lengths are sensed and reported, and other situations shorter lengths are. So we have conflicting signals about what, there's no such thing as a length, right? I can't tell you that 10 repeats are sensed, but 100 repeats are not, because in any situation it could be different. What I can tell you with age is they decline, or with division they decline.
But in different chromosomes, is length the same or different in same cell?
We don't know that, and because we don't measure individual chromosomes, we usually measure the aggregate of all chromosomes, because we can't separate individual chromosomes to measure that. However, it's usually one chromosome that's doing the signaling, and I can say that because if I stain for ATM and I look at the chromosomes, it's usually on one chromosome, and it's on the one that's signaling, right? So it could be different chromosomes from different cells, even in the same population. There's a lot of heterogeneity that doesn't allow me to give a good quantitative answer to your question, which we'd like to know, of course, but we haven't really.
But intracellular still, there is no connection.
Everything's in the cell. Yeah.
You always draw simple arrows, but I guess that's these biological arrows where there's a tens of proteins in between that pass on the same.
Actually, P16 binds to cyclin CDK4 and shuts down the active side of the protein kinase, so there's nothing in between.
But there, ATM to P53.
Yes. ATM to P53 has one guy in between. Another protein kinase that is important, but it's not a very big pathway. But you're right, I'm sort of skipping because I don't want to name 100 intermediates. I'm just sort of giving you the path that gets you to some place and stopping at the big player, right? So, yes.
Why is the design such that, you know, stresses stop cell cycle? Why do we need this?
Because stresses cause mutation rates to rise. And everything in the cell cycle is about making sure you have fidelity, right? That's why I started with the...
But doesn't it, you know...
a good thing, right?
It can be even worse. If the cell cycle is stopped. What? And it can be, you know...
Worse?
It can be deadly then, no? It's not?
No, the worst that could happen is maybe the cell dies, right? Cell death is cheap. Right? You got a lot of cells. You're, you know, 10 to the 14th, 10 to the 15th cells. So suppose you lose one. In fact, you're losing one right now, right?
I mean, sorry, I lose you.
Lost many, I don't know. I mean, but yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so death is cheap, right? Cancer's harsh. Making a mistake is a bad thing. Dying is not so bad in a multicellular organism. If you're a single cell organism, hey, you don't want to die, right? So what's quite interesting, if you think about it, is we're enforcing fidelity with death, right? Life, in fact, someone asked the question about cells dying. Like the default in any cell, the default situation, if I have no signals, I have no glucose, I have no growth factor signals, right? The default situation is death, right? So a cell in the absence of any signaling will die. And it will die of a programmed death, a planned program. And this is the killer, right? Because in addition to P21, it's got other programs for death. I'm not going to give you all the genes in the program, but it can kill, right? So if it sees there's too much damage, and it knows it can't be repaired, and it knows you want that cell, you don't want that cell hanging around, right? It will kill. So it's a veneer, in some ways, of watching the amount of damage as well. Yeah.
So
in the, along the path of evolution to multicellularity.
Yes.
So roughly where does p53 appear in the trees?
Yeah. So yeast do not have p53. Sea anemone have multicellular organisms. They have two germ layers. They have ectoderm and endoderm. Sea anemone have p53, and it's quite amazing. This is a way. This is a tip-off to tell you how important. Actually, Mickey is going to give a talk that's not so dissimilar to the point I'm making next. Maybe he'll talk next week. Sea anemone not only have a p53, the structure of the DNA binding domain of that p53 is identical in structure to the DNA binding domain of humans. And yet there's 600 million years of evolution between them. The DNA sequences they recognize and bind to are identical. The function is identical, except that it is functioning in the germline, right? So sea anemone are interesting little creatures. They live in estuaries, right? And they live deep down in the muck, right? But they, whenever they get hungry, they come up to the surface to feed on the bacteria, which are taking advantage of the sunlight, right? And so they eat the bacteria, and that's their food. Now, when they're up high in the sunlight, they get UV irradiated. So their germ cells suddenly get thymine dimers. P53 senses the thymine dimers and kills the germ cell. Right? That's exactly what it's doing here in humans. Except it's not germ cells in humans, it's our somatic cells, right? So in sea anemones, 600 million years, right? Flies, 400-500 million years. Worms, 500 million years. There's a P53. It has the same structure, it binds to the same sequences, it lives in the germline of these organisms, and it enforces, I'm going to tell you experiment in a minute, it enforces through death, right, fidelity. Right? Now let me tell you a really amazing, this experiment I like a lot, right? So worms, Xenorhabditis elegans is a worm that's used in the lab a lot. We feed it E. coli. So these worms swim around in the agar and they eat the E. coli, right? So you can starve them. So you put them under nutritional stress by starving them. And they respond very quickly by not laying eggs, right? Egg production stops. Why? You don't want to lay eggs in a barren environment. You don't want your offspring to die of starvation, right? What kills those eggs? P53. It senses nutrient deprivation and kills the eggs, right? An anorexic woman who is not taking in glucose has apoptosis of her eggs, right? She then shuts down estrogen production and she doesn't have menarche anymore. She doesn't menstruate anymore, right? That's all through P53 death of the ovary, of the egg cells, right? So this, the mechanisms have been tremendously conserved in evolution for stress responses, and these stress responses are enforced by death. Right? It's really quite a severe way to enforce it, but nonetheless, that's what P53 does. And here it's enforcing by cell cycle arrest. Yeah.
It seems like you're talking about an isolated. You're toggling between multicellular organisms and one. Is there
no? They're all multicellular. Everyone in my talk about is multicellular. Yeah.
Is there any trigger between cells that were identified to affect what P53 does in another cell once this one is dead?
It actually communicates with the immune system to get phagocytosis. In so that that you clean up the dead cells.
Okay.
But it does so by these other genes are, for instance, calling in granulocytes, macrophages, other kinds of cells. So it's a coordinated response, okay. Right? But I'm just giving you the highlights, yeah, not the subtleties, yeah.
So if you inherit a cancer which is related to P53 malformation, does that happen everywhere in all tissues?
Yes. So no.
No.
So just like retinoblastoma, there are people who have inherited P53 mutations. Like retinoblastoma, they're heterozygous. Right? These people get with 100% probability cancer. They frequently get it at an extremely young age. right? So cancer, if you just look at the population statistics, the incidence of cancer rises by 1,000-fold after the age of 55. Right? So between 55 and 75, there's a 1,000-fold increase in the rate of cancer. That you'll see is due to the accumulated mutations over a lifetime. And the last one is the killer, right? It's the one that's getting you, right? That's why it takes so long. Because you inherit P53 mutation or retinoblastoma mutation, the curve moves to the left. You get it at younger and younger ages, right? And so people get it at young ages. There are people with P53 mutations that get 5 independent cancers over a lifetime. That shows you the fidelity problem, right? And this is called Li-Framini syndrome, right? And in every cancer, it reduces the homozygosity. That is to say, it's a homozygous mutant that is present in the cancer. So it's just like retinoblastoma. These inherited predispositions to cancer are due to these genes which are negatively regulating the cell cycle, right? These genes, this P16 mutations give rise to melanomas. Now you could start to sort of translate this right to the cancer. People with P16 mutations that inherited it get melanomas. The Li-Framini people, they get sarcomas, they get leukemias, they get some brain cancers, but that's it. So the spectrum of cancers is enigmatic. Yes.
I was puzzling a bit about your point about why is it just one protein instead of having the typical biological redundancy. And you said that actually P53 mutated people get quite 5 different cancers, and I was thinking only 5. By the size of the importance of P53 you've been talking about, I was expecting them to just
melt.
Don't even have a chance, melt away.
Yeah.
And then the indication could be that one protein is just enough to do the job as much as we needed it in evolutionary time.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, 1,000 years ago, we didn't get older than 30 anyways. So cancers of, let's say, lesser importance as far as evolution is concerned. So maybe it's just one player because it's good enough of a job until rather recently.
Okay, so now you've asked a great question, and the answer is actually well understood in the field, as it turns out. Right? P53 mutation is necessary but not sufficient to give rise to the cancer. Right? And so it, most cancers, so if I draw a curve now, remember I told you, now I'm going to go age, right, versus number of cancers, but this is rate actually, rate of cancers, right, so rate per year, right, there's a little blip down here which is the leukemias and lymphomas in kids, but don't ignore that, right. Remember I told you it goes up 1,000-fold as we pass 55 and go into our years, right? So this curve actually helps us understand a little bit about how many mutations it might take to cause a cancer. Why? Because if I have P53 or RB, right, mutations, RB might be here, right? It moves the curve to the left. So that's one less mutation, right? So the exponent on this, there's a binomial equation that explains this, and the exponent on it is about 4, 5, or 6, right?
Yeah.
So it suggests that there are about 5 independent mutations that are driving a cancer. Now, this is a great setup for what you're going to hear on Thursday, right? Because we have a guy coming in on Thursday who actually sequences cancers. Right? And so I'm just giving you an inference from the epidemiology. He's going to count for you, right? So let me give you give you an idea of what trouble we're in, right? There are if you just look at the exons, right? Just look at the coding regions, right? You'll see on the average of 50-60 mutations in a cancer. If you look at the whole genome, you'll see 17,000 to 60,000 mutations. So the cancer is a desert of mutations. It's a mess, right? And that's on the average, that's an average distribution across a tumor. One of the things Mickey might talk about is what happens if I look at one cell at a time, right? it's even a bigger disaster of heterogeneity. The net result, though, is that the statistics tell us this epidemiological process and some of the genes that we know of tells us that it's a kind of 4, 5, 6 mutations to get there. So if you inherit one, you lower the age at which you get it, but you don't get it at birth. You don't get it, you know, the minute you have the first division, right?
But basically that's what I mean. I mean, that sort of, to phrase it in a different way, P53 is important, but it's not so important that you really need it redundant.
It's actually non-essential. It's non-essential. I can knock it out in a mouse and get a mouse to be born. So it is not an essential function. It is a fidelity function. So insofar as fidelity is essential, it's essential, right? But fidelity, yeah, you can be sloppy, right? You can cheat a little.
Right? Yeah, like you were saying before, it might actually be that you want a little bit of infidelity.
Well, so now that you, I love your questions, because I'm giving a whole lecture, I mean, I've been stressing fidelity, right? And Darwin, 160 years ago, pointed out that if we want to evolve, we have to have lots of differences in the species, and those differences are in a big distribution of alleles that are different, right? That's, in other words, it's terrible to be faithful. If we actually very faithfully reproduced ourselves, we couldn't exist. And the reason is that when the environment changes, we'd all die together, right? And so Darwin pointed out that this kind of distribution of phenotypes is really critical. And working against that are fidelity factors, right? So it's this balance between fidelity factors, which are insisted on by death, right? And mistakes, which are important to generate diversity in the species, so that the selection can act upon that diversity, right? Is a really interesting balance, right? And that is a great, if we take on nothing else from this, it is that's the reason this thing is 1 billion years old in evolution. It is this tension between fidelity and lack of fidelity that has allowed the evolution to proceed in such a good way, interesting way. However, it also has a lot to do with cancer, because without it, when you will get cancer with 100% probability, it just won't be, you're right, at birth or even before birth, right? And so a very interesting thing you'll see, even though mice are born that look perfectly normal, they are not quite normal, right? So remember, I told you metabolic processes are checked by this, right? But this is, I get feedback between nutritional impact and P53, and the feedback goes back the other way, right? These mice have terrible staying power. You put them on a wheel, and they quit very quickly, right? And that's all about generating ATP in the metabolism they use. They are, to put it in the terms of some people who will understand it around here, and I'll pick it up tomorrow, they are in a Warburg life. They live by glycolysis and nothing else. Right? They don't have oxidative phosphorylation as a way to generate ATP, these mice. So if you stress them, they're terrible. Right? But you know, life in an animal colony is pretty good, so these guys are okay. About a third of the females, this is a sexually dimorphic thing, about a third of the females are born with birth defects. That you might expect also if fidelity was an important issue. Right? So there are reasons to think that this is important, but you can get a mouse without it. You can get a human with half of it. They just have really bad phenotypes, that's all. All the mice get cancer as well. Okay, so here now we have we understand M1 and, right? Yes?
So just to go back to that, kind of the M2, there's an apoptosis pathway that gets excited and die?
No. So. I'll take you through it now. Now you know everything for me to take you through it at the molecular level, right? Cells start dividing. Now, P16 starts to be a drag on division. Why? Because it's inhibiting cyclin B and slowly slows the rate, right? Some cells stop, can't go farther, right? ARF, well, I haven't told you how ARF works. So The stress response is a kind of interesting response, and this is a good lesson in the biology of the system, right? You want a stress response that's fast, right? So actually, this stress response responds fast because everything is done at the protein level. You don't require any transcription, which is a slow step. Transcription is a really slow step, right? So remember I told you that the DNA polymerase works at 50 base pairs, right, per minute, per second. RNA polymerase works about 150 base pairs per second. There are some genes it takes a whole day to transcribe. So there's some genes that you couldn't get to respond for 24 hours if you were relying on transcription because the rate is so slow. So everything is done at the protein level, and there is a protein called MDM2, which is a ubiquitin ligase. I'll tell you what that is in a second, for P53. It actually marks P53 to be degraded. And this is a loop where P53 makes MDM2, MDM2 kills P53. So that's the dynamics between these two genes. The killing is as follows. You mark it to be degraded, it moves to a place in the cell where it's degraded, and it's degraded. So the half-life of P53 in you right now, you're all at rest, nobody's stressed, right, is about 6 minutes. So it's synthesized, its half-life is 6 minutes, and then it's trashed, right? And it's all because of this relationship, right? This is also, you'll recognize, because this transcribes this gene, so that's a slow step. This marks this gene, so that's a fast step. That means there's an inequality here, so we have an oscillator. We actually oscillate, these two oscillate, and they oscillate 180 degrees out of phase. So you can just see that. I can mark this guy with a red fluorescent protein, this guy with a green fluorescent protein, and I can see them oscillating in the cells. Right? I turn on stress like this, and that stops oscillating. Why? Because I turn off this guy, and the half-life carries this up very rapidly. Right? So this is a rapid response because it's all at the protein level. Right? Now, ARF inhibits MDM2, allowing P53 levels to go up. ARF is going up, P53 is going up, P16 is going up. We finally come to nobody dividing. Right? Everybody's at rest. All blocked in the G1 phase of the cell cycle, right? SV40 comes in. Remember I said it has two genes, SV40? One gene is called T antigen, the tumor antigen, right? And what that protein does is it binds RB, and it binds P53, and this liberates E2F, and this kills P53. We have a virus that does the same thing that the mutations do in humans, right? And why is it doing it? It's killing RB, right? Because it wants to get the cell into S phase so that its own DNA can be replicated. But as a byproduct, it is bypassing this step completely and moving the cells into S. So the cells start dividing. If it integrates into the chromosome and the cell survives and it makes T antigen, right, it's as if you're knocking out the two major proteins that are important for M1. And they'll bring you to M2, right? And the second failsafe happens, just let me finish. The second failsafe happens, telomerase is not there. And the cells die, they crash because they're making fusions and chromosomes are breaking apart and there's invasion and there's a whole bunch of crappy things happening. And over a million cells die. And anybody who survives is a cancer cell. And 90% of the time they turn on telomerase. Right? So now coming out the other end of these cancer cells is terrible looking chromosomes, big survivors, mutations in RB and P53. Or clones that always have SV40T antigen on. You turn off SV40T antigen, remember that temperature sensitive mutant, and it stops the growth. It brings it back to here. Right? Yeah.
If I take your, you said this P53 turns over very rapidly. Mm. and I don't really understand how T antigen can significantly lower the p53 levels, because it would be, if it's they're getting degraded,
it actually raises the p53. Yeah, it raises the p53 level. So what here's what's happening: when ATM phosphorylates p53, it no longer degrades, and so its half-life starts creeping up, and then it functions, right? What T antigen does is doesn't even permit that to happen. It inactivates p53, whether it's phosphorylated or not. It sequesters it and blocks it completely. It, in fact, takes it away from MDM2. So T antigen will do this. Take it away from MDM2 and just stop it. Dead. Right?
But there's a new one produced right away, right? I mean, every 6 minutes.
And there's a new T antigen.
But does it keep it or does it
destroy? No, there's a new T antigen. So let me tell you about the viruses, and you'll, because I want to do experiments with a slightly different virus, a human virus, right? So SV40 makes T antigen, which takes p53 at RB, right? Then there's a group of viruses called papillomaviruses. This is the group I want to work with because they're human, right? So this is a common wart virus, actually. So when you get a wart, it's a benign tumor, right? And but it also causes two other kinds of tumors. One is cervical cancer. That's Henrietta Lacks, right? She has a human papillomavirus, actually, integrated zones of the tumor. And it makes two proteins. One's called E6. And one's called E7, right? E7 binds RB, which liberates E2F. E6 binds P53, and it degrades it. Right? Slightly different strategy. Now you're happy because it's degrading it. It's just like MDM2, right? As long as you have these two guys, it's fine. In Henrietta Lacks's cells, they've been in culture since 1950, right? So that's 62 years now. If I knock out E6 and E7, they're normal. They just go back to being normal. They'll go through the count and die. Right? So this guy is producing two proteins that force the cell into S phase so the virus could replicate. But when integrated, it causes these cancers. Now, there are other mutations in the Henrietta Lacks cells. It's just that they're not sufficient to cause the cancer if you get rid of these two, right? These two are big players in that path, right? There's a third group of viruses. They're all independently derived viruses called adenoviruses, which have proteins called E1A and E1B. Right? E1B binds P53, E1A binds RB, right? So this is a strategy for all the DNA tumor viruses. This is a strategy. These viruses had to get over this problem of the cell sensing them and then shutting down, right? And they get over it by knocking out the two nodes for the cell cycle, right? So papillomaviruses are true human viruses. There's a relative of SV40 called the poliomavirus. Human poliomavirus, which causes something called Merkel cell tumors. That's a rare cell type, but it's done the exact same way. It binds RB, right? So these viruses have used these strategies, and they became tumor viruses because of the strategies they used to get through the cell cycle, right?
One thing that comes back again and again is that they don't understand tissue specificity.
Yes, and we don't understand it either. So one of the things that we're pretty sure of, but haven't got a lot of evidence for, is maybe RB and P53 don't work the same way in every tissue. So let me give you an example of that. I know the P53 literature really well, right? So if I take a mouse, so that's this, because I have to do tissue specificity, and I put it in a cesium source, so it's now got gamma radiation, so I'm making single and double-stranded breaks that alarms P53. It does the following. There's a wave of P53-dependent apoptotic death in the bone marrow, in the spleen, and in the thymus, right? Those are all the blood-making cells. That's radiation sickness, right? Radiation sickness is caused by P53 death, right? If I block P53 death, right? I don't get it. If I have a knockout mouse for P53, I don't see any bone marrow death, I don't see thymic death, I don't see spleen death, right? The other place where you have very actively dividing cells is your gut, right? The gut cells are not killed by P53, they're thrown into cell cycle arrest. Right? So that already tells you that there's tissue specificity in the responses to the same stimulus, right? And we don't understand the mechanism of that tissue specificity, but that demonstrates the tissue specificity in responses to the signal transduction pathway that's P53. One uses death heavy, that's in the bone marrow, one uses P21 heavy, that's in the gut, right?
I keep coming back to this.
Please. Good.
Have they? So I presume that these codes under different stresses, right? So you can do repeat this tissue culture experiment with a constant stress on it.
Yeah, you could. Yeah.
And I guess I'm asking: has anyone tried to compare resulting codes and put them onto each other? And so P53 is really.
People have selectively inactivated each of the players, right? Or added other players to this. So I can selectively activate P53, I can selectively activate P16, I can selectively add or subtract telomerase, right?
Well, that's what the stresses as an environmental stress.
Yes.
But I appreciate
that. One of the stresses that was referred to this morning is that we often run our tissue culture properties at high oxygen content. That is a stress, right? I'll tell you an interesting experiment. This is something we observed in the lab, and it surprised us at first, but it shouldn't have. If I take your blood, right, in your blood cells is P53, right? And these are the cells that are part of your, coming from your bone marrow to make your blood cells, right? So if I irradiated those cells, P53 levels rise, and you get apoptosis, right? So if I look at the level of P53, the minute I take your blood, it's very low. By 1 hour in cell culture without any other treatment, by just sitting in cell culture, it's gone up 50%, right? That tells you that the cell is a little alarmed, right? Maybe has some damage, maybe on average across the culture, right? It's a little alarmed. I irradiate it, it goes up fivefold, tenfold, right? And now the cells die, right? So obviously our culture conditions are alarming compared to the, so this has been done under some stress, but there hasn't been a systematic evaluation of different stresses, if you mean like nutrient deprivation, things like that. Yes?
Just as a quiz to see that actually understanding all of it, right? So this sort of experiment you wouldn't necessarily want to do with as a function of number of generations, right, looking at the length of the telomeres, wouldn't you just want to look at the cell cycle, have a dish with some cell cycle indicator so that you can see transition from G1 to G2 as a change of color, and then see what happens to cell cycle as you irradiate them as a function of...
Yeah, I just put it in this context, but that's been done a lot, and of course, anytime you irradiate them, as soon as you get a reporter to phosphorylate P53, it's phosphorylated, it goes up very rapidly, and programmed in is P21... No, I should say, P53 has P21 to stop here, right? It, P53 also makes in G2, right, two genes, CDK25C and 1433 sigma, right? Two things you don't want to memorize, right? What does this do? This sequesters a phosphatase, right? This phosphatase, it's absolutely essential for the G2 to M phase transition, right? So it's a G2 blocker as well as a G1 blocker, right? So in fact, it's really quite interesting. Without P53, one of the first things that happens with SV40 telomeres when you don't have P53 is you get aneuploidy. You actually go through two S phases before you go through an M phase. And you get tetraploidy, and then that signals out to aneuploidy, right? And that's all because these blocks in G2 aren't proper, right? it is actually, there's some count on to tell you how many that you finished S phase, right? And CDK25C, which is a P53 regulated gene, is the phosphatase that releases it to M phase. Right? So there's actually different blocks in different parts of the cell cycle that the stress responder is responding to. There are many, and we know of lots of them all throughout, right? The problem is with S phase, and you can now see the problem. If I draw you a replication fork, right? If I draw you a replication fork, you can see it looks like damaged DNA. And ATM would see that as damaged DNA. Right? So during S phase, P53 becomes allergic. It's shut down. Because you don't want to alarm it while you're replicating DNA. Right? So there is a stage that it doesn't surveil. But it actually, among all these genes that I haven't listed, there are a bunch of DNA repair genes, things like that, that play a role in repair.
And that presumably is part of the answer to the question of tissue specificity, because different tissue then will be in different, stuck in different
In fact, that's, it can be, that's right. Yeah, tissues are rarely synchronized, though. Yeah. Okay, almost all the these negative regulators I've been talking about are called tumor suppressor genes, right? Why? Because if you lose both copies of them, they normally are there to suppress tumorigenesis. You can inherit these copies, and if they fail to function, you develop tumors. A P16, you get melanoma, right? RB, you get retinoblastoma and osteogenic sarcoma. P53, you get a load of different kinds of tumors, right? So all these are negative regulators are called tumor suppressor genes. Cyclin D, right, which when amplified and overproduced and drives the reaction is an oncogene, right? It's positive regulator, okay? And there, if you're heterozygote for a positive regulator, if you turn it on, one copy's enough. You don't need both copies knocked out, okay? So let me just get you to the retroviruses, because they are really interesting, and they were, just as the cell cycle and the story I told you was the uncovering of the tumor suppressor genes, the retroviruses uncovered oncogenes for us. So oncogenes are positive regulators of the cell cycle, and tumor suppressor genes are negative regulators of the cell cycle, and it's the balance between the two that's important. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about retroviruses, because they're really quite amazing viruses. It's the only thing to say about retroviruses. First, why are they called retroviruses? Just let me, for those of you who are not very literate about viruses, the structure of this retrovirus are two copies of RNA, so they're diploid, actually. They have two copies of chromosome RNA, and they're different retroviruses at different amounts. But the standard retrovirus is about 6 kb, 6,000 base pairs, and has three genes. It has a gene called GAG. It has a gene called POL. And it's a gene, right? And the RNA is wrapped in a protein coat. This is protein. Protein is made from the GAG gene, right? So the RNA is wrapped in a protein coat. Now in that protein coat is the packaging of the POL gene product, the POL protein, right? That's polymerase for POL, right? And this protein coat is surrounded by a lipid envelope, which actually comes from the cell. It's made by the cell. Right? And in the lipid envelope are a series of glycoproteins which allow the virus to attach to cells, and that's called the envelope protein. Right? So you can see GAG, POL, three viral proteins, very simple guys, right? right, now, POL is a very unusual polymerase. It actually copies RNA into DNA, right? It's the only enzyme, actually telomerase copies RNA into DNA, right? Remember, telomerase has its own RNA inherited in it, and then it makes a DNA copy and it sticks it into the chromosome. And so that's a reverse transcriptase. That's why these are called retroviruses. These poles are called reverse transcriptases, right? And so the first stage of the cell cycle is the virus attaches to a cell, it's inserted, right? And these RNAs are made into DNA copies. And actually, it's made in two steps. The first step is RNA to DNA. Then the RNA gets degraded. So there's actually an enzyme that degrades the RNA in the DNA-RNA hybrid. It's called ribonuclease H. And then the DNA is copied one more time to make double-stranded DNA. And very nicely, this is circularized, right? So the DNA is a double-stranded DNA that's a circle, right? It then moves into the nucleus, where it's integrated into the chromosome. Right? So it becomes part of your chromosome. It's integrated fairly randomly, pretty random process. Right? And at that point, it makes RNA, messenger RNA, which goes out back out into the cytoplasm and makes proteins. And then the RNA is packaged by those proteins into viruses. And the virus replicates that way. Right? So this is a sort of standard protocol of a retrovirus. It has RNA, makes DNA copy, DNA gets integrated into the chromosomes, makes RNA again, comes out, makes protein, assembles around the RNA, that's the messenger RNA, and out it goes through the membrane, right? Now, that means that every infected cell inherits a copy. Now, it's not in your germline, although many get into your germline, and an awful lot, Sergio studies retroviruses that have gotten into human germline, for example, and something in the neighborhood, was it 52% of our chromosomes are retroviruses?
8% will be explicitly dragged onto a retrovirus.
8% are explicitly retroviruses, but related to retroviruses are retrotransposons, which actually just don't have the envelope gene. They just have gag and pull.
And that'll be 21%.
And that's another 21%. Right? And I think in total, if you're looking for these things, it's about 50% of our genome have these kind of viruses in them. So they have been extremely successful in parasitizing all the living forms on life, right? And this was all written up a long time ago in a wonderful book called The Selfish Gene, right? The Selfish Gene is a gene that has found a way to persist throughout evolution as part of us, right? Like 50% of our genetic information derives from these guys, right? So retrotransposons and retroviruses are a very interesting strategy. Now you can see why HIV is a retrovirus. You can see why it's really hard to cure HIV. You can inhibit the virus replication, but it persists as copied DNA in cells that are going to divide, right? So you can't get rid of that, right? Okay, so it turned out that there were two kinds of retroviruses that were first found. They were actually first found in chickens. But first found in chickens and mice and rats, rabbits, yeah.
So for HIV, you cannot prevent it from going in the nucleus, but you can do it for germinal lines, for instance, for some drugs. So why can you do it for germinal lines? You can prevent it from going to your baby when you're
yes.
So why can you prevent it from germinal line and not
the mother is actually passing along the virus to the baby at birth. It doesn't pass the placenta, but at birth. So there's a lot of blood. It has a lot of virus in it. And the baby would get it, right? But if you keep the titer down very low of the virus that it's being made, you're not getting rid of it in the mother, but you're keeping the titer down very low, you don't get transmission efficiently, right? And that's exactly the strategy now that people use. If you took a lot of drugs to prevent the titer of the virus, the amount of virus, to be very low, then transmission is very inefficient. Yeah. Remember I said retroviruses live on the edge of this error catastrophe. They're like influenza, right? And so there's a lot of defective viruses, and keeping the titer down low really weakens them. They transmit very inefficiently. Right? In fact, in the sort of experiments of nature that have been done, when you know at what time a man has gotten gotten retrovirus infection, right? And you ask the question, when does he transmit it to his wife, when he didn't know, right? It turns out to be a very inefficient intercourse is a very inefficient transmission, which is a major way of transmitting it, except for blood transfusions, right? Okay, so turned out there were two kinds of retroviruses. It's a very nice story, so worth maybe I'll tell it quickly. There was a guy named Peyton Rouse who was trying to study cancer at Rockefeller Medical Research Institute in about 1910. And he was visited by a chicken farmer from New Jersey who brought a chicken in with him. And he said to Peyton Rouse, "You see this chicken, he has a tumor, right?" And he did, he had a breast tumor, right? It's called the sarcoma. It was a tumor of the muscle of the breast, right, of the chicken. And he says, "This is really terrible. My entire flock has this." Right. Peyton Rouse said, "Oh my goodness, how do you get an infectious kind of cancer? How do you get a cancer where the whole flock has it, unless it's either inherited or it's transmitted, right?" So he took the tumor and he ground it up, so he got no cells left, right? And he took the supernatant with no cells in it at all, and he inoculated another chicken and he got a tumor. And then he filtered it and he showed that the size of the particles that were transmitting were very small, smaller than any bacteria, and he announced that he had found the virus that causes cancer in chickens, right? And that virus came to be called Rouse sarcoma virus because of the sarcoma and Rouse. And Rouse sarcoma virus had an RNA. It had gag, it had pull, it had end, and then it had something else. It had an extra gene, right? Now, no one knew that because no one was looking at genes in 1910 or whatever. So it took until the 1970s, right, for the first time when cloning experiments could be done, right, to actually ask the question, what is this extra gene, right? And one of the first experiments was done was to get rid of that extra gene, making a mutation in it, and it no longer made tumors. So everybody said, "Aha! This is the gene that's causing the tumor." Because other viruses have gag, pull, and end, and they don't cause sarcomas. So they call this extra gene sarc. Right? Now, they clone the sarc gene finally, and they put it back into cells, and it transformed the cells. It immortalized them, actually. It completely changed the cells into cancer cells. Right? Well, they moved it around into another virus, and they could get sarcomas. Right? So this was called the sarc gene because it was causing sarcomas. That's a single gene now. This is contradictory to everything I've said this morning where I said it takes five genes takes five genes to cause cancer. This is a single gene. It's because it's so highly overexpressed that it actually pushes the cells to grow. Tumors are real, but they're abnormal in many ways. And then what Bishop and Varnas did, who were working on this, did a really insightful experiment. They asked the question, is this sarc gene present in the chicken, the normal chicken, right? And they found the same gene in the normal chicken. And that really perplexed them. How can you have the gene in the normal chicken, and then the virus carries the gene and it causes the cancer? So they got, finally, those are the days when sequencing was really hard, but they sequenced the genes, and they found out that there was a mutation in this gene that in the normal sarc was called C-sarc for cellular sarc, this was called V-sarc for viral sarc, there was a mutation in the virus that the normal gene didn't have. Right? But that was kind of interesting because this gene turned out to make a protein that was a protein kinase. And the VSOC protein kinase was on constitutively, and the CSOC protein kinase was off. Right, so just the turning on constitutively of this. Turns out this is an important protein kinase in a signal transduction pathway. If it's on constitutively, bang, you have a big problem, you get the cancer, right? And so what had happened evolutionarily was this virus picked up a cellular gene. Well, because it makes errors at a high rate, there's a lot of mutations in these genes. One of them caused cancer. Right? The chicken farmer saw the cancers and got alarmed and brought the chicken in. Peyton Rouse propagated it because it caused cancer. Right? That's called natural, it's not natural selection, it's artificial selection, right? By scientists. Right? And now, by 1970, from 1910 to 1970, Peyton Rouse got the Nobel Prize for this when he was about 80, right? Because it took that long to figure out what it was. But now, suddenly, it dawned on everybody, right, what was happening here. That you could, of course, change a natural gene in the chicken to a cancer by a mutation. It doesn't have to be in the virus, right? So chemical carcinogens would work on this. Anything that caused mutations would work on it. And it just happened to have been picked up in the virus, right? And SOC became the first so-called oncogene, cancer-causing gene. And that set off a flurry. From 1976 to 1990, 240 new oncogenes were found. They were found in viruses. They were found in various ways, right? And so I'd heard recently someone claim that there are now 460 genes which are cancer-causing genes, of which 340 of them are oncogenes, that have been found to cause cancer under a variety of conditions. Right? So those are all in signal transduction pathways that either flow through the cell cycle or do things like that. They tend to be tissue-specific, right? As you'll see in a minute, right? They tend to be tissue-specific. This causes sarcoma. But nonetheless, they're in these pathways, right? Now, there was one thing kind of left here that I haven't said to you, but was a little perplexing to everybody else, and that is that these viruses themselves, without the oncogene, actually could cause leukemias and lymphomas in chickens. And they actually grew in these cells that they caused leukemias and lymphomas in. But they didn't have oncogenes, right? And so I haven't stressed it, but here, when they go from RNA, when they go from RNA to DNA, they actually copy one end twice. And in so doing, they put on either end of this linear form that integrates, right? Something which acts like a promoter, right? And the promoter is the place where RNA polymerase binds and transcribes the gene, right? Okay. And that's called a long terminal repeat, for anybody who cares to know the name, right? And they integrate randomly, right? Sometimes they integrate next to an oncogene. So I'll give you the name of a great oncogene, MYC. Right? If this integrates next to MYC, it overexpresses MYC. If it overexpresses MYC, it's just like carrying an oncogene. Now you can even see how this, the origin of SOC happened. The origin of SOC happened by integrating next to SOC, including it in the transcript, and finally getting some transcript that was long enough to have extra RNA. Right? So oncogenes were discovered in two ways. One is packaged in viruses, and the second is adjacent to where retrovirus is integrated. Now, just to show you, this is not some huge chicken experiment, right? There were people who were doing gene therapy in France. And you do gene therapy by replacing genes into human beings. They're doing it in humans, right? But only in the most dire straits, right? So these were kids that actually were the bubble chamber kids. You may have an imagination of the bubble chamber kids. These are kids born without an immune system. They miss deaminase. They miss one of the deaminases, but I'm trying to think of what it is. So these are kids that are missing an enzyme, and it doesn't allow an immune system to develop. So when they're born, they'll die of infections right away. They have no immunity. So they're put in bubble chambers where they don't get infections. But they can't live, you can't live your whole life in bubble chambers. So they decided to replace the enzyme in these kids, right? And they took the human enzyme, they put it in a retrovirus, and they inserted the retrovirus into these kids, hoping that a new immune system would, right in the bone marrow, hoping a new immune system would be generated, right? And four of them got leukemias. And they got leukemias because the retrovirus integrated adjacent to the MYC oncogene. And when it integrated adjacent to the MYC oncogene, they got an immune system, but they got an immune system that resulted in leukemias. So that actually happened in children as well as happened in chickens. Anything that these animals are good models for human beings, right? So it stopped, obviously, completely stopped the experiment. But the net result of this, so retroviruses are really sort of interesting viruses. They are in a germline. They are really hard players to get to eradicate, right? And they were the origins of discovering oncogenes. So there's now MYC, for instance. What is MYC? It's like E2F. This is MYC is just like E2F. They're transcription factors that turn on all the genes for the cell cycle, and that throw the cell into absolute growth, right? And MYC translocations are common in B-cell lymphomas. So people have MYC translocations that increase the level of MYC. It's a great example of one of the oncogenes, right? So now what we have, let me just sort of step back and say, through the efforts of this sort of 20-year discovery process, we have about 500 genes in the genome. There are about 25,000 genes in our genome. There's probably more because we haven't really found all of the little RNA genes and things. But in today's parlance, there's 25,000 genes, of which about 500 are oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes, which in some combination have to be activated or inactivated to give rise to a cancer. Right? And that happens over our lifetime. That's why cancer is a disease of the elderly, by and large. This activation and inactivation happens over a lifetime in a single cell and grows up, right? Many cancers are completely indolent. On Tuesday, I'm going to talk about prostate cancers I think 85% of prostate cancers are totally indolent. Yeah. Hmm?
Today's Tuesday, that's all I said.
No, next Tuesday, actually, at lunch. At a luncheon, I'm going to talk about how do you find people who have the most virulent kinds of cancers versus the indolent kind, right? This is this pit. So here's what happened. It's a very interesting situation. So, 20 years ago or something, the PSA test appeared, right? PSA test was for people that were producing a protein that the prostate makes, actually, if you have an inflammation or if you have cancer, right? So people thought that would be a great way to diagnose cancer. So it's just through a blood test, prostate cancer. And immediately, two things happened in the population. The first is the incidence of prostate cancer actually doubled in the United States, right? That was remarkable in itself, that the incidence actually doubled, right? It's, of course, the detection actually doubled, right? And the age of detection moved from, on average, 72 years to 59 or 60 years, right? So the age of detection moved up 10 or 12 years, the incidence doubled, and the death rate stayed exactly the same. Now, how could that be? How do you double the incidence of a cancer and the same number of people die? Right? Well, half the number of people actually died who were diagnosed, right? Because and that meant that we were diagnosing an enormous number of cancers that were never seen before and didn't matter, right? And that's true of many cancers. So they're combinations of oncogenes, tumor suppressor genes that give rise to these cancers, can be diagnosed at some level if you really look hard enough, but don't look too hard is the take-home message, right? Because in that case, just this week there's been a big debate because it's like mammograms. They've decided to do away with PSA tests. When you go to your doctor from now on, you don't want to get a PSA test, right? So That's a great take-home message for everybody, not to get PSA tests. But what can you do, right? So I'm going to stop here, unless there are lots of questions. I'd be happy to continue answering. And tomorrow we'll pick up, I don't know what. We'll pick up signal transduction pathways that will get us into, so we'll start filling out one or two of these pathways. And the reason to do that is because there's some pathways that are really interesting, like this pathway called the insulin-like growth factor pathway, which mutations in this pathway double the lifespan of animals. Mutations in this pathway are the second most common mutations in cancer. The most common mutation in cancer, now that we have a lot of sequence information, 100% of ovarian cancers have P53 mutations. That's actually answers one of the questions we had about how important could this be, right? 100% of ovarian cancers have P53 mutations. 60% of all cancers have P53 mutations. And probably 90% of all cancers have something that inactivates P53. The second most common mutational change is in something called PI3 kinase, which is in the insulin-like growth factor pathway. This is the pathway that regulates metabolism. So we'll have to talk. I'm going to actually show I don't want to write up the metabolic pathways, so I'm going to show a overhead of the metabolic PowerPoint of the metabolic pathway. Yes?
Is there any connection between those oncogenes and P53C? So does P53, you know, see a stress if...
Yes. You just asked a question I promised I would answer, but I didn't. So let me just give you the connection, and you'll see. Really kind of interesting connection. Oncogene activation is a stress. It's a stress because it's an inappropriate movement into the cell cycle. You're bypassing RB or you, right? So remember I told you there was an INC 4A locus and it has P16 and it has ORF. And ORF inhibits MDM2, which inhibits P53, right? So P53 levels go up when ORF is made, right? There's a promoter here. Where all of the transcription factors which are downstream of these pathways for oncogenes, right, act. So E2F turns this on. NIC turns this on, right? You're going to, as we go through various things, beta-catenin turns this on. That's important in the pathway you'll hear on Friday, the WNT pathway. So beta-catenin is the transcription factor of a pathway that's important in colon cancer, right? All of these transcription factors turn on the off gene, right? So that means anytime there's a mutation in your body which activates an oncogene, the first response is to turn on ORF, which turns off MDM2, which turns on P53 and kills the cell, right? So if I take an oncogene, and there's a very popular oncogene which is commonly found in pancreatic cancer called RAS. 100% of essentially pancreatic cancers have RAS oncogene on, right? First thing that happens when you turn RAS on is it makes a signal transduction pathway that turns ETS on. ETS turns the off gene on. Off turns off MDM2. P53 kills the cell. So a single oncogene mutation is killed by the tumor suppressors, right? That would lead you to think that the first thing you want to do is get rid of the tumor suppressors, right? But actually, as it turns out, there's other ways to counter these things. So, or it goes into senescence. It doesn't kill, but it waits, right? But I'll describe the colon cancer that we talked about when we talked about polyps. A very common mutation, it's in fact a tumor suppressor gene, is called APC. APC is a ubiquitin ligase scaffold for the beta-catenin transcription factor, right? And you have it in your gut, right? Colon. If people are born without APC, right, they have a tremendous increase in the frequency of colon cancer. Or you have a spontaneous mutation in APC, you get a polyp. What is the polyp? The polyp is beta-catenin, that's the oncogene downstream of the pathway, constantly driving growth. And P53 being sensed through the off, constantly killing the cells. And that's the benign tumor, right? P53 is lost, and the benign tumor becomes malignant. Right? That's a little simplistic, because there's a couple of steps in between, but nonetheless, it's pretty much what happens. Right? So a lot of these tumors are kept benign, or kept down, right, by constant death. Right? So you're under constant surveillance, even though many of your cells are getting these kinds of mutations. Now that's why people who have P53 mutations get tumors at very early ages, right? Because they don't have that fail-safe mechanism, and it moves the age at which there are kids who are 2 years old that have P53 mutations that get tumors that adults would normally get. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm totally convinced that T53 is important. But
I didn't mean to come too big.
But it's missing in yeast, and yeast
yes.
cells have ATM and ATR that
yes.
integrate. So
yes.
what's going on there?
I think that yeast don't usually like to kill themselves. So I would have said, what I'm going to say is turns out to be more complicated than I'd like it to be. But I would have said that since yeast you grow in the laboratory, we grow as single cells, then cell death as your default isn't a good idea for a single cell, right? Now, in truth, for those of you who really know yeast, you know that if yeast was growing in you, it wouldn't grow as single cells, it grows as multicellular tubes. So it can have a multicellular form, in which case that wouldn't have been a bad time to kill something off if it did something like damage one of the cells. But there may be other mechanisms. We've been looking in yeast, or trying to look in yeast for a long time for the alternative to P53, which might even be the precursor in some sort. There are response genes to damage in yeast, which are alarm response genes. They're not P53-like, though. There's not the suicide pathway in yeast. That's like bacteria. There's not the suicide pathway. Yeah.
There are wonderful questions being asked, but I think we should save a little bit of Arnie's voice for tomorrow. I suggest that maybe we clap and then continue questions a little bit more in private, okay?
You're worried that I'm not going to have a voice tomorrow.
You okay?
I'm fine. I'm all right.
Okay.
I'm drinking a lot. And I'm really looking forward to a martini. Is there a 4 o'clock martini hour? Yes.
Kind of a politically incorrect question, but is it possible, is there numbers then? Because it seems like the human race is accumulating more and more P53 mutation, and do we have numbers, or is it significant, or do we have numbers about this kind of stuff?
So, I'll give you numbers. In the United States, there are about 250 families with P53 mutations. The reason that number doesn't change, it doesn't accumulate, is twofold. One is there's this rather unusual, and I'm going to give an explanation for it, but ill-understood phenomenon called progression, right? Or anticipation. In the first generation, you'll have a grandfather who has a spontaneous P53 mutation, and he'll die of colon cancer at the age of 55. In the second generation, you'll have a daughter and a son who will die of breast and brain tumor at the age of 35. In the third generation, you'll have three kids who will die of leukemias, lymphomas, or sarcomas at the age of 3, 5, and 7, right? Notice there's a progression or anticipation in generations. Now, if someone dies at 3, 7, and 9, they're not having offspring, right? But even more important, I've now met a half dozen people from Lee-Fraumeni families. They don't want to have offspring anyhow, right? They're psychologically extremely traumatized individuals. They know they're going to develop cancers with time, right? And the last thing they think about is having offspring. Even if they get married, they don't want to have offspring. So these mutations die out in populations frequently, right? That means that a spontaneous rate creates them, and then they die out, usually over three generations.
But this psychological effect is only for pretty serious mutation like P53, or where it's kind of instantaneous. But for less serious mutations.
I see. Yeah, sure. Yeah, so there can be several mutations that predispose people to cancer that we don't really know too much about. There are certainly DNA repair mutations that predispose people to cancer. People that can't go out in the sunlight. People who have ataxia telangiectasia get cancers at a high rate that they can't recognize double and single-stranded breaks, right? Those are the severe ones, right? But then there are very subtle ones which we really don't know a lot about, actually. But you're right, the population it's an interesting observation to make. If the population has children at younger and younger ages, right, then you're a little bit in jeopardy of accumulating at older ages in the germline, even, right? You don't know that you're going to get cancer at 60, right? So you have children at younger ages. It turns out there's a wonderful longevity experiment. This is what I actually talked about in a luncheon here once. The experiment is done in flies. The experiment is going on now in humans. But it take a few generations, right? But it was done originally in flies. What happened was flies were first used in a laboratory by Thomas Hunt Morgan at Columbia University around 1905, 1906, right? And what Morgan wanted was flies that bred fast, to have many generations really fast. So he caught some fruit flies, and he bred them as fast as he could, right? So they get sexually mature in a week, and he bred them, right? But they stay sexually mature for 2 weeks more, right? Or a week and a half more, right? But he didn't want to wait that long, so he bred them, right? And everybody felt that way. So they always bred the flies as fast as you could possibly breed them. That's the rough equivalent of, 12 to 15-year-olds having children in humans, right? As fast as you could breed them, you get them bred. As fast as they become sexually mature, you breed them, right? But that's artificial selection, right? And the flies live about 2.5-3 weeks in the lab, right? Then someone got wild alleles and crossed them into these flies just to give a little diversity to the lab flies, right? And they started breeding them late. They waited 2 weeks to breed. Not 1 week, but 2 weeks. They doubled the time at which they breed, right? And in 10 generations, they increased the lifespan by twofold. Right? Now that's kind of interesting. That's evolution responding. That's your lifespan markers responding to the age at which you have offspring, right? And this is in flies. We're not talking about, you could imagine that occurring in humans where there's all sorts of hormones, changes, and so forth. This is in flies that are doing a count as to when they were bred, right? And that's the selection pressure. So now, it makes a lot of sense that you're going to live longer if you're bred later, right? Why? Because you want to be there to lay eggs, so that you don't want to die at the time you're supposed to be laying eggs, right? So lifespan is extended. That means you can extend lifespan, right? That means, and it's sensing when you're using your sex cells, right? When you're having offspring, it's sensing that, right? There's a feedback loop between the sex organs, even in flies, the sex organs, and longevity, right? The longevity locus in flies and humans is the same. It's the insulin-like growth factor pathway. That's why I tell this story, because my lecture tomorrow morning will be about the insulin-like growth factor pathway, right?
So you want humans to become sexually mature at the age of 8?
Well, so, no. So the very interesting natural experiment is going on now. People are breeding at later and later times, right? The average age at which women and men are having offspring is 10 years later now than it was when I was a kid, right? When there was a big rush to have kids, right? And so just a natural experiment of the sociology of what happened in population. Now, it took 10 generations to breed this in. I don't know how long it will take for us. But, right? I mean, the first generation doesn't get any gain by breeding later, that's for sure. Right? But, so there's a kind of interesting set of relationships here. There's a lot of feedback right? And one of the things that these pathways is telling us, I'll go through if you care about it. We've spent the last 10 years looking at the feedback between the insulin-like growth factor pathway, that's the pathway that regulates this, and P53, the stress pathway, right? Because you would imagine that stress plays a role in this case. And boy, do they talk to each other. They have genes that talk to each other in a tremendous amount. Everything is connected in a really serious way. That's the kind of genetics that we were talking about, right? They really talk to each other. So
I was very confused when you said there's a feedback loop, but it could just be selection, right? I mean, it doesn't have to be a feed. It could just be that the ones that live longer are more likely to have progeny later on. So that's the population that gets stuck in. So there doesn't have to be a feedback loop in the sense of that.
Doesn't have to be, but actually,
you're saying it flies there, really. There is.
Yes, so as people investigate this question, right? Yeah, it turns out that there's a hormone made in the brain. The flies don't have a pancreas. So that is, right? A little known fact. But flies don't have a pancreas. So the hormone made in the brain looks a lot like insulin. And it's the hormone that is expressed at the time you're having offspring. At the time you're mating, right? And so there is hormonal signaling in the fly. And that's the hormone that regulates the insulin-like growth factor pathway, right? So, and that's the pathway where mutations extend lifespan. Right? So I'm going to suggest there's a feedback loop without having nailed it, right? But not a bad hypothesis right now. But you're right. It could have been that for some structural reasons that, you know, in fact, clearly evolution doesn't want to preclude you from having offspring, because if it did, you wouldn't be around anymore. Yeah.
But the flies are post-mitotic, right?
The flies are post-mitotic, but not their germline. Not their germline. The only thing in a fly that's not post-mitotic is making eggs and sperm. Thank goodness for flies. Yeah.
So the hormones keeps the age of the fly longer. Right. So the age is increasing, the post-mitotic tissue, which is getting a longer age based on hormone secretion.
Yeah, so there are dozens of these little peptides made in the brain, which we haven't sorted out which ones are important, but which interact with the insulin-like growth factor pathway. And there are some that actually mark the laying of eggs, the fertilization of eggs, even if it's done extracellularly, right?
Arnie, are you saying that Lamarck was correct?
It's actually close. There are a lot of people that want to revisit Lamarckian ideas in the sense that there's feedback loops that Lamarck, you know, I don't think his example of why the giraffe has a long neck is particularly correct, but there may be in the sense that the environment has a big effect on the alleles that we choose to use, right? But we have to have that diversity in the population. Had we narrowed the population funnel so much that everybody's exactly the same, you never would have gotten that alleles until you regenerated it. So the cheetahs in Africa were going extinct, and there was a very nice guy in Arizona who decided to take a couple of cheetahs and get them mated in Arizona and bring them up, right? And he had reached a critical mass of 70 when the virus came in and killed them all, right? And killed them all because they were all sensitive to exactly the same virus. They all had the same immune system. They were so inbred that they hadn't had enough time to get that diversity, right? So there's a critical time when a species develops where you need time for diversity.
But the feedback that you're talking about presumably is very different. Yeah. So presumably the effect is when are they going to actually produce eggs? Are they going to produce them at the time when they're going to mate, or long before then, in which case they will be wasted? Right. So then you want all sorts of environmental sensors.
That's
so
right.
For example, if they're starving, because only they have
That's right. No, absolutely. There's an environmental overlay that is very important in whether you want to lay eggs or not. Right.
And then ultimately,
remember, I told you about the feedback to kill eggs if you don't have the right nutritional environment, right? So it's true, there's a lot of variable, but this is this multigenic effect that we sort of get stuck with. I mean, one of the problems here is the connectedness of the system, it gives you tremendous amounts of fine tuning on the system. Last question.
Thanks. This morning you explained to us when you take juvenile cells and put them in an older environment, do you then just expose them to higher levels of ARF in P16, or what's making them die faster?
No, so if I take the cells from the circumcision, for example, that's what I think you meant, right?
Yeah.
They go through the full 80 generations, but if I take the cells from a 50-year-old, it'll only go through about 40 more generations. So I was making the point that the clock is on in you, right? So that in other words, you're off, and you're P16, and you're, right?
Yeah.
You're at your age-appropriate amounts of these kinds of expressions.
Sorry, I
yes.
Understood.
Yeah.
So this business of distribution of telomere length really is very interesting, and so you only describe things which are averaged, right?
Yes, these are the average. That's right. Yeah.
Individual, right?
Yeah.
And age dependent.
Yes.
But presumably there is a distribution
in your body. There's a distribution.
Body percent.
That's correct.
Having to do with stemness and
exactly.
Is it possible to actually measure length of telomeres in a single cell?
In theory, it is, because you could use PCR, and in any case, when you use PCR, you can get from a single DNA molecule up to a detectable amount. The problem with telomeres is that they're repetitive, and the efficiency with which you actually get them up to the amount and all this stuff is a little bit suspicious. So it'd be interesting to ask that question in known telomere lengths that you would take from a single cell and ask how reproducible it is and things. I don't know.
So you're saying that it's possible, but not
particularly? I think it could. Mickey doesn't like it, so that's a good start. Mickey does a lot of, well, he's involved with Wiggler, who does a lot of single cell experiments. Yeah.
I think the answer would be yes next year, but not the current technology. The reads are just way too short. So this business of repeats is a compounding issue, and there's no way you can ascertain the telomere length.
Repeated so one of the sort of less than pleasant facts is repeated sequences are sequenced very badly by present sequencers, and not detectable at all by PCR reactions that amplify genes. We're always amplifying unique genes, right? And there's a whole, actually repeats are the fastest thing to change in humans. So that your kids don't have the same repeats you do, repeat lengths, right? Because mismatch repairs and repeat lengths are really bad. And mismatch repair defects cause cancer. So there are repeats are hard for the body to maintain. So PCR reactions can exaggerate and amplify them and make them, right? So it's a little bit, measuring telomere lengths even in whole cultures is not an easy thing. You have to have really good, you take primers, you have to have really good primers, you get a distribution. The distribution is frequently stuttering of the polymerase reactions, right? So the technical reasons why it's not a beautiful experiment to do, that's why I didn't want to calculate the number of telomere lengths, you know, and things like that, because technically it isn't a gorgeous set of experiments. There's no real answer to, you know, how many molecules, how many base pairs are there left at the end of a chromosome when it's ready to die, right? But because technically we have a hard time measuring that. So what we do is we just don't ask those questions, you know. Because we're not technically capable of answering it, right?
But clearly it's not changing, because the way you explain it, it binds the end of one strand to the other and so on. And then when the cell divides, it has to somehow disconnect. Where it happens is stochastic. Since it's a repeat sequence, there's no way that it can decide.
Well, there's a machinery there that does something that we don't have a very good handle on. Okay, now I'm checking.